5AA Mornings
with Matthew Pantelis.
Let's talk the law. We've got from Duncan Bashir Hannan, the principal partner in Peter Jackson. He's happy to take calls on any legal issues, or most of them anyway. But we want to talk medical negligence today as well, but certainly don't let that stop you if you've got a legal question for Peter. He'd love to hear from you. Peter, medical negligence, good morning to you. Tell me a little bit about what that is and where people stand in it.
Good morning, Matthew. It's really an interesting topic because a lot of people think about medical negligence and they think, oh, it's something when the doctor does something wrong. Mm. And that's actually a really good definition at the end of the day. It's really thinking about things like your GP or your surgeon or a specialist, or it can be things like a physio or a chiropractor or someone allied health psychologist, essentially doing a treatment which is beyond this normal standard.
Right.
So it's...
My definition would have been the surgeon who leaves the scalpel in you after he finishes.
I've done some of those cases. Not so much scalpels, usually swabs, okay. But same idea.
Yeah.
But it's really, end of the day, the way it's defined is essentially another doctor of that same skill or ability needs to actually look at it and say, in my view, it's within the Australian standard that occurred or it's not within that Australian standard.
Right. So you need to find someone who a different expert, essentially, to give you the rundown.
That's exactly right. So in these cases, we usually go and see two or three experts to make sure we know what we're talking about before we do too much.
Okay. What do you need to prove to make a claim?
There's three steps you've got to prove. One is what we call negligence, which is obviously we talked about a minute ago. The second is what we call causation. That is that the negligent act caused you an injury. So that can be quite complicated sometimes. And the third is that as a result of that injury, you've then suffered a loss, so a financial loss, what we call quantum. So there's three steps you've got to prove, essentially, to make a claim.
Okay, all right. So there's a bit in that. And how much history of a medical professional do you take into account? I mean, if he's done it before, there's a pattern there, I guess.
It's useful to know if there is previous history of those sort of things. But at the end of the day, quite frankly, you've really just got to take it back from basics and start saying that the question is, well, should they have done what they did?
Yeah.
So to give you just a complete example, quite often what happens is that a patient might see the GP and the GP misses that there's potentially a cancer marker that's available.
Yeah.
That patient goes away for the next 3-4 years not realising they've actually got cancer.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, they do in fact have cancer and they come back when they've got a lot of pain down the track and they didn't have scans, et cetera, and it diagnoses it. And the issue is, if you looked at that result earlier on, that would have said there's potential for cancer and you would have done more investigations, missed it. It's not intentional on the GP. The GP didn't decide to go and say, I'm going to miss that result today.
Yeah.
But they did make a mistake, and that mistake is the thing that's caused the claim.
Right. What if somebody has an operation and it was unnecessary? And you know, from as simple as having a tooth removed or a filling made when there's not a filling that's needed, for instance, or, you know, something more major than that, and it's proved later, well, you actually didn't need that course of treatment.
It's certainly something I've seen on a not irregular basis is that maybe the inappropriate treatment's been done. Mm. So, for example, you've got a broken leg, for example, and you come into the hospital and the hospital says, what we're going to do is we're going to plaster it. But in reality, the treatment that should have been done was because of the nature of the break, should have actually put a plate in.
Right.
Because reality was never going to heal without
it. Okay.
That's a very straightforward case. And it's one of those ones where the hospitals are usually pretty helpful in saying, yeah, look, we made the mistake. We should have done differently. Then it's just a question of what's the value of it.
Okay.
But we've also seen other cases over the years, like, for example, extreme cases where I've had one person that's had a digit amputated from their wrong hand.
Wow.
I've also had cases over the years where, and there are a few people that this is more intentional, where they recommend certain treatments that you don't need.
Mm.
So without particularly naming a profession, I've certainly had some clients where they've gone in for manipulation type treatments and things like that, and they shouldn't have had those particular treatments because it wasn't actually necessary for their condition.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, that's actually caused them an injury having had that treatment. So you do sort of get the spectrum a little bit, but most of the time it's not an intentional act. Someone doesn't go out to say, I'm going to hurt somebody today.
Yes, of course.
It's really more just, and to be honest with you, and for a lot of doctors, it's not the doctor's fault insofar as they've probably got a very large load, large patient load because they're working in a public hospital, et cetera. And the reality is that we've all only got so much finite space in our brain to think about things.
Yeah.
And you've probably done a 12, 14-hour shift and your brain is just shot and you've unfortunately forgotten something.
Mm-hmm.
But that mistake, unfortunately, has cost that person an injury.
Yes.
And at the end of the day, what we're not talking about, we're not trying to blame anybody. We're not going out there and saying the doctor made a mistake and they're at fault. What we're really trying to do is to say, look, there was a mistake made, and realistically, this person now got injured. We need to actually make sure this person looked after now. Yeah. So we're looking then as what the value is of that, I suppose. Right.
Let's go to calls, and they don't have to be about medical negligence, as I said. Could be anything, and Raymond has called in about a property issue. Hello, Raymond.
Yeah, good morning, Matt. Good morning, Peter. How are you both?
Good.
Good, thanks, Matt.
Raymond? Good, good. Peter, I recently bought a property. I suppose it's a rural property, but it's domestic. Now, the problem is that there was no fences around any of the properties. It's a bit of a hamlet, and nobody had fences up or anything like that. And sold or told on the, you know, the premise of the real estate agent that a boundary is in X spot. And subsequently, people have moved into the neighbouring houses and had them surveyed, and it turns out that the block is not as big as we first believed. What's my recourse? How do I go about getting it sorted?
It's actually a really good question, Raymond, and a lot of it really comes down to going back to the original contract of sale and looking at what they actually promised that you'd actually be being sold, and then looking at whether you've actually been sold something other than what you actually sold. And if so, then there's potentially a claim either against the vendor or alternatively the agent, depending on who actually did that work. But it's one of those things that's really hard to do on the phone now, obviously, because we need to look at the actual contracts and talk about what you actually got versus what you should have got, I suppose.
Okay, so how is it decided if there is any, recompense or change of remuneration? How does it get decided? Is it a case of redrawing of boundaries, or is it financial compensation, or what? And what's the best way? Like to take the contract and the advertising material in to see a lawyer at first instance, or what's the best place to start?
I think you answered your own question there. The bottom line is you are going to have to take the materials in to see a lawyer, unfortunately, because the reality is that without having that material in front, it's really hard to answer. But it's not going to be redrawing of boundaries, because at the end of the day, the other person legitimately has that block if that's what's recorded in the Land Title Office. The issue will be more about if there's a compensation. The issue will be if they've actually provided you with a copy of the title, which they're required to do, and that title shows what the property legitimately is, but you've misunderstood it from advertising material, then it's potentially a claim against the agent for misadvertising it. But the question is whether you're then relying upon the title or the agents, and that's where it gets complicated, and that's why you need to see a lawyer about it, I'm afraid.
Would Raymond need to get the block surveyed? Maybe you've done that already, Raymond.
No, I haven't had it surveyed. Look, if this property is in a small hamlet just across the border in Victoria, as I said, pretty much the whole town, there's no fences in any of the properties. But the material that was supplied to us at the time of sale shows the boundary. There's a natural feature in the land, and the boundary was sold to us or mentioned to us that natural feature is the boundary. In actual fact, one of my neighbours has had their block surveyed, and the boundary, according to them, is nearly 2 metres away from that natural feature. So you can imagine that, you know, it's probably 2 metres by 10 metres of land that we've lost, and the boundary is a lot closer to the house than we otherwise were led to believe. So, it's caused a little bit of angst, particularly for my partner. So, yeah.
I think, Merriman, you really are going to have to go and see a lawyer about it, just because at the end of the day, the lawyer actually looks at it and sees what you've actually been offered versus what you got, and it's probably going to end up having to be your own surveying as well. So it's probably not one we can do right now, but I strongly suggest you have a chat.
I totally understand. But, Peter, do I need to see a specialist in this field, or, you know, is it one of the lawyers, your company or another company, or do I need to find a specialist lawyer in that?
You really want to find a lawyer that does property law. We've got one in our firm, but at the end of the day, because it's a Victorian matter, it's probably better to see a Victorian firm that specialises in property.
Okay, all right. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Raymond. Great call. Great questions. Let's get back to medical insurance and the issue of rehabilitation. That would make up one of the costs, and probably the biggest cost, I imagine, that somebody would claim for.
It can well be. As I think, Matthew, you know, I do quite a lot of claims with baby injuries where, unfortunately, mums have given birth and the child's been injured during birth. And those children, unfortunately, quite often will suffer. Well, not quite often, but those children in the claims I do quite often have a brain injury as a result, so hypoxic injury during birth.
Yeah.
And for those children, you're talking millions of dollars in rehabilitation expenses and medical expenses. You're talking millions of dollars in care needs, et cetera, during a lifetime. So I accept that's the extreme end, if you like. But the reality is some of these claims are very large claims. And again, I want to stress that we're not necessarily saying the doctor's gone out there to do that. But unfortunately, on that day, this has happened.
Yeah.
And those poor children in those cases have a lifetime ahead of them of suffering. And some of those kids, that life expectancy is not that much reduced as a result. So they've got decades. Your or my lifetime to actually go through, but with massive traumas. And some of them are blind. Some of them can't communicate. Some of them are unfortunately bedbound and with feeding tubes, et cetera. So the suffering they go through for their lifetime, they need the proper compensation for that rehabilitation, et cetera, so at least they can live the best life that they possibly can.
Yeah, absolutely. Medical negligence, it must be a process that takes probably longer than anything else to resolve. And you've got to find experts and test it out and all the rest.
It's unfortunately one of those areas where it takes years to actually sort out. And the problem is because each of those three steps we can't resolve without expert evidence. So as a lawyer, I can certainly speed things up at my end and I can send out letters very rapidly, et cetera, but I'm very reliant upon somebody else to do work as well. Yeah. So quite often I might request a report, but I might not see that for 3, 4, 5 months down the track. And if you can imagine, you've got to get evidence in respect to each of those areas.
Yeah.
2, 3 years, unfortunately, can go through before you can get to that point of negotiating a settlement. So, and in some cases, because the injuries are so bad, it just takes even longer because you just don't know how bad those injuries are to actually put a number on things until they settle down.
Yeah. Are there time limits for making medical negligence claims in the state?
There are. So like all personal injury claims, if you've been injured as a result of negligence, the standing point is 3 years from the time of the negligence. That potentially is longer for children. So with children, that will potentially be until they're 3 years after their 18th birthday, so when they turn 21. The other thing to bear in mind is that sometimes we have what we call a latent defect injury, where we don't necessarily know that someone's suffered an injury at the time of negligence, didn't even know it was negligence. Yeah. Example, the cancer case I gave you a little while ago is a good example of that, where the GP misses a diagnosis and you don't find out before 5 years later. In that scenario, you might be waiting, the clock starts ticking at the point that you actually find out that the GP misdiagnosed.
Yeah.
So there are times where you potentially get extensions, but because of those strict limits, I really encourage people to see a lawyer sooner rather than later, just because at the end of the day, if you leave it to too late, it'd be very hard to rehabilitate it down the track.
Yeah, all right. It's certainly a complex area, and anyone with any questions regarding that needs to speak to you or a good lawyer to help deal with that moving forward.
I'm not sure I like the whole or a good lawyer.
Oh, sorry. No. I meant you, and you're a good lawyer. How's that? And you are, clearly. You do these cases, so you know what you're doing. I want to take a quick break. Of course, people can ring in and ask an excellent lawyer here in Peter as to any legal questions they have. Peter Jackson, partner, Duncan Bashir Hannan. I want to ask you too, when we come back, about this submarine that they're searching for, this vessel that has taken five people down to the Titanic. They had to sign disclaimers. And the question is, how binding are they? Because I've signed them here in SA to do different things, and especially if you go on a tourism-type activity, you get asked to sign a disclaimer. We'll find out just how binding are they when we come back.
5AA, Adelaide's number one station for sports. Thanks to Rossdale Homes. Home of the absolute fixed price contract. No builder's variations, no nasty surprises.
This is David Mann, man about town for Chemist Warehouse. Chemist Warehouse is proudly supporting Gotcha for Life Foundation. So they're donating 5% of each participating product sold towards mental fitness, like L'Oreal Men's Expert Range from $2.97. Bio Revive Mouth Ulcer Relief 8 capsules for $10.69. Advil Minis 90 liquid capsules for $16.99. And Gillette Labs Razor with exfoliating bar and 2 refill blades for only $27.99. There's also many more products helping fund the charity. See the catalogue and in-store for details. Chemist Warehouse, great savings every day. Chemist Warehouse, why
pay more? Did you know the average funeral service runs between 40 to 60 minutes? And in some cultures, it can last for days. For a service that suits your wishes, talk to the team at Simplicity Funerals. Simplicityfunerals.com.au.
You can always expect the very best from designer appliances at Adelaide Appliance Gallery, which means right now, when you come in store and mention this ad, you'll get half price installs on dishwashers, washing machines and dryers. Plus, you'll receive a 6-month supply of premium cleaning products by Power of Four. Now till the end of June, just mention this ad. T's and C's apply. Head to the home of Mr. Dishwasher and discover designer appliances at Adelaide Appliance Gallery, Paynham Road, St. Peter's.
Treat yourself to a winter getaway and unlock something extraordinary, a complimentary minibar. Book direct with participating SA Weekend Escapes hotels this winter and enjoy a free minibar upon arrival. Discover some of South Australia's hidden gems, from Barrie to Victor Harbour to Kangaroo Island and more. Immerse yourself in picturesque landscapes, indulge in gourmet delights and embrace unique experiences. Visit saweekendescapes.com.au to unlock your free minibar and embrace the magic of South Australia.
Think of all the items on your eBay wish list. New tech? Furniture? Parts and accessories for your car? Now, imagine they're all yours. Nice thought, isn't it? This end of financial year, eBay is offering unmissable savings on all the items you love. With 20% off millions of items, just head to ebay.com.au to turn your want list into your got list. T's and C's apply. Limited time only.
TAFE SA is looking for volunteer tutors to support migrants and refugees with their English language learning and help them thrive in the South Australian community. As a tutor in the Adult Migrant English Program, you'll receive free training, develop new skills and meet students from diverse cultures for 1 to 2 hours a week. To find out more, visit tafesa.edu.au/VTS. A message from the Government of South Australia, RTO code 41026. VTS is funded by the Commonwealth Government Department of Home Affairs.
Matthew Pantelis on 5AA Mornings.
Peter Jackson, partner Duncan Bashir Hannon. He's got a badge to prove he's a great lawyer. And I've got questions, Peter, on the text line. Catherine asked, good question. I had a total knee replacement, and after 4.5 years, I've limited movement in my knee. The surgeon fobbed me off, saying it could take 5 years. I got a second opinion and was told, but also shown reports, I didn't need a knee replacement at all. I don't want compensation, but is there recourse for the surgeon who gave me the unnecessary knee replacement?
So there's two types of claims we talk about. Yeah. One is what we call a compensation claim, which is what I do in my industry. And the other is what we call essentially a regulatory claim. So with the compensation claim, that's where you're looking for someone to actually pay something for the fact you've suffered that injury.
Mm.
The regulatory option is more in relation to the fact that someone's caused you an injury and you're looking to potentially have that person reprimanded in some way as a result. If it's through a public hospital, one of the options is to go through the Health and Community Services Complaints Commissioner. If it's through the, if it's a private surgeon, the option, other option is the Australian Health Professionals Regulatory Authority, APRA. They have the ability to actually make findings with respect to doctors, and they do their own investigations. And if they believe that the doctor's done the wrong thing, mm-hmm. as in this sort of case,
yep.
then they can actually take steps against the doctor, whether that's putting restrictions on their practicing certificate, whether that's suspending, whether that's cancelling practicing certificates, or things like ordering extra education and things of that nature. So that if you're not looking for compensation, the way to go is potentially to look at something like ARPA or to the HCSCC, because one of those two options will allow you to actually make a complaint and have someone investigate that still and determine whether there was actually something that's been done incorrectly.
Yep.
And if so, should there be some sort of re-education or regulatory action taken as a result of that.
Yeah, all right, so there's a few steps there. I don't know if you can help with this one. It comes from a number that regularly texts in on COVID and the vaccine. Can you ask about medical negligence against the vax, the COVID vax, due to adverse reaction? Is there anything that can happen there?
At the end of the day, there's actually a compensation scheme that's being run at the moment by the federal government. That scheme allows for compensation where you've suffered a injury as a result of that vaccination. Those claims are actually being processed at the moment. The important thing is that that scheme has a 2-year limitation period from the time that the emergency declaration was removed,
okay.
which is, I think, less. There's now only less than 12 months left until that scheme finishes.
Okay.
It doesn't mean you can't make a claim up until the 12-month mark. Right. You can still keep on making the claim until it expires. But once that scheme expires, you can't make a claim at that point. Mm. So as long as you're in before that end, that two-year end period, you'll be okay. But don't leave it too long.
Is there a compost scheme for other vaccines, you know, the traditional ones we've had forever?
No. At the moment, okay. The only one that's in play that I'm aware of, at least, is the one for the COVID-19 vaccines.
Isn't that interesting? All right. Tom is on the line on advanced care directives. G'day, Tom.
Good morning, gentlemen. I apologise, this has already been covered, if not today, then recently. What's the latest with advanced care directives? Are doctors actually taking them as rigid, or is some doctors still overriding the patient's wishes?
If a doctor's aware of the advanced care directive, then there's some binding ability as far as them actually using them, and then certainly in public hospitals, for example, where they're aware of it, I'm very aware that they're very keen on complying with those directions. But the issue is realistically the awareness of it. So part of the thing I always suggest to people when they do an advanced care directive is that if you've done that with your, make sure you give it to your GP, for example, and have that put on the file of the GP, because that way when someone like a specialist rings the GP and says, oh, I've got this patient and I need their history, one of the pieces of history they'll be given will be the actual fact that there is an advanced care directive. Mm. So they actually know to ask questions about it. Similarly, I always suggest to people if they're going into hospital, whether it's going into a private or a public hospital, make sure you take a copy of that with you and make sure you provide it so it's actually on their system. Because if they don't know about it, it's very hard for them to actually comply with it. So part of the important thing is to actually give the information to the right person so that they actually then can actually comply with it, essentially.
Mm. Right. But legally, can they still override it if they choose to?
They shouldn't be overriding it if they're aware of it. I am aware that some people still tend to do so, but they shouldn't be doing so is what it comes down to.
Can you take action if they do?
It's a grey area. I'm not going to pretend to know Megan, who was here last week, would be the perfect person to answer that question. But I'm aware that there is some people that have actually taken some actions about it. But the question is, well, what's the loss associated with it? So let's say, for example, you've put in a clause that says, I don't want to be resuscitated, and they resuscitate you, and you're still alive today. What's the loss that's associated with that? And that can be quite a difficult question in some scenarios.
Yeah. All right. Yep. Good on you, Tom.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Disclaimers before we wind up. Now, the people on the submarine had to sign one to obviously acknowledge the risks, and it certainly seems to be risky from what we know of it today. But I've certainly signed them here in SA, just doing things like I've done tree climb with the kids. I haven't done diving with the dolphins or the seals, as happens around the country, and you can do it out on the West Coast and other places. But where do you stand with whatever they're for, disclaimers of undertaking some sort of, particularly, I suppose, tourist-type activity where you just want to do it for the experience and you're not thinking too much. Bungee jumping would be one, wouldn't it, where you'd have to sign a disclaimer?
There's a concept in Australia, particularly in South Australia, called obvious risk.
Yeah.
So even if you don't sign a disclaimer, if it's something that's obviously potential to cause you injury and you choose to go ahead with it, then there's potentially a restriction on you making a claim.
Okay.
The disclaimers are actually taking it a step further because they're essentially getting you to acknowledge that there is this risk and that you're accepting that risk, so therefore they can say you knew it was an obvious risk and therefore you still chose to go ahead with it, and therefore you can't make a claim.
They're covering themselves
essentially.
Twice. Yeah.
But the reality is there's a few problems with those disclaimers, depending on particularly age of people. So, for example, a child can't disclaim a child's rights.
Okay.
So, under legislation, an obvious risk doesn't apply to someone of a young age.
Right.
So even though they get you to sign the authority, sign the waiver, and you take your children to the tree climb, for example, it doesn't actually apply.
Right.
So I may have had a few arguments with the tree climb people when I took my children there for that very purpose.
Good on you.
My wife may have got a bit angry with me about that. That's another story. I hope she's not listening at the moment.
That's a parallel universe. That's all right.
But those sort of things, disclaimers are important because it's essentially getting you to, you should read it and understand what you're signing. And if you have read it and signed it and you've acknowledged that there is that risk, then essentially that potentially stops you from making a claim is the argument. But there is also an argument to the contrary of that, which is that where is a negligent act, that something that was clearly shouldn't have occurred. So, for example, use the tree climb example. You've got a rope that's no one's actually checked to make sure is safe, and yet they've still let you use it.
Mm.
Then potentially the waiver doesn't apply. So there's legal arguments that go back and forth on that. Yeah. So it's not a black and white type scenario. I always suggest to people, prefer you didn't sign a waiver before you go and do things, because obviously from my point of view, it makes it harder.
Yeah.
But even if you have signed a waiver, it's still worth having a chat to a lawyer about it, because it's not a black and white, definitely okay. You can't make
That's
the claim.
Interesting. And just with Tree Climb, I'm sure they do check all their ropes. It's been
I'm
very
sorry,
clear.
Please. I was not in any way trying to impugn Tree Climb's ability to... the ropes I used were very good.
I've done it a number of times. It's excellent. It's fun. So, yeah.
But I think the key from my point of view is really about when you're signing a waiver, it's actually reading and understanding what you're doing. Yeah. So, for example, I have done the whole swim with the seals thing, and it's actually just reading what you're actually signing. It's the same thing as advice I give you. If you, for example, you go to the Telstra shop and they get you to sign a, or usually get you to tick the box on the iPad to say that you've actually read the product disclosure statement or the contract that you assigned before you actually buy your phone. Okay, you're not going to be able to change it. So you're not going to be able to say to them, I don't want paragraph 10. Because they're going to say, I don't care what you want. If you want to have the comp phone, you'll agree to this agreement.
Yeah, that's right.
The important point is to read it, though, because it actually there are actually things in there to actually help you. It's not just stuff that hurts you in there.
Right.
So, for example, it talks about that if you can't pay your bill for a particular reason, that there are rights that you have to actually go to them and say to them, I'd like an extension of time to pay or a hardship clause, etc. The problem is if you don't know about them and you don't exercise them, then they'll come chasing you for the money and you've missed the opportunity to use those clauses.
Yeah.
So while you might still say, I'm not going to bother reading this before I sign the thing, personally, I'd always recommend you read it before you sign it.
Yes.
But if you're not going to read it before you sign it, still actually read it afterwards, because some of the information in there is actually important for you to know, not because it's going
your
to...
Your rights.
It's just your rights, basically.
So. Yeah, good advice. Okay, you're the guy I've realised who holds up the tour group, reading all the fine print before you sign anything, and they're waiting to get in with the seals. All right. Peter, now next week you're bringing somebody in to talk about property disputes and the rest.
So I thought next week might bring in someone with me to talk about family law and property settlements.
Yep, perfect.
And we might come back and have a chat about workers' comp in the near future as well, but I'd be very keen to know if anyone else, if there's anything else anyone else wants to talk about at the end of the day, because there's topics you're burning to talk about. Let us know, because I'm more happy to find the right person and bring them with me to have a chat.
Excellent. Good eye. Thank you, Peter. And if people want you in the meantime, of course, Duncan Bashir Hannan is the place to contact.
Indeed, dbh.com.au.
Terrific. Peter Jackson, partner at DBH.